This is The Sweeper, the global football podcast with the best worldwide news and stories from the beautiful game, with Lee Wingate and Paul Watson.
On this episode of The Sweeper, we reflect on a memorable trip to the Prague derby between Slavia and Sparta, a VAR scandal engulfing Croatian referees, and the mock Rosario derby attended by thousands of flair-holding fans. Hello, hello, and welcome to the latest instalment of Global Football Goodness with myself, Lee Wingate, and my co-host, Paul Watson. The only logical place for us to start this episode is, of course, our recent trip to the Prague Derby, the quarterfinals of the Czech Cup last week. Paul and I were joined on the road for the experience by our Patreon competition winner, Joe McTaggart. We'll hear more from him later on. But for now, let's reflect on a great 36 hours in Czechia. Perhaps starting with your hotel room.
Yes. So this was a hotel room unlike any other I'd stayed in. Got into the room, you know, tired after traveling and thought, oh, you know, just maybe have a little rest here. And then just thought, I'll just draw the curtains and see what the view is. And it was directly onto the pitch, basically. You had the view of the stand going down to the pitch and you could see everything. It would be the perfect view for watching a game, basically.
We actually requested some of these rooms with the pitch view before going on the trip, didn't we? But they told us at the hotel, you can't actually reserve one. But I don't think it would have brought us much, would it? Because once we got into the stadium, we saw very clearly that you wouldn't have seen anything from the window during the game.
Yeah, because the strange positioning of the room is you're directly in the stand of the ultras. It's a stand that the Slavia Prague ultras all gather in and make the most noise. But the funnier thing is, that you were on exactly a level with some of the fans that would have been stood in front of you. So you would have been stood basically behind the back row of the ultras. But even funnier, the glass wasn't obviously one-way glass. So the ultras would have been able to turn around and just see this guy in his hotel room. And I'm sure I probably would have got a lot of stick from them at some point if they'd realised some weird English guy is just perched at the back, desperately trying to see over the top of their pyro and their tifos and stuff like that.
I think it would have been really funny if somebody had tried to stay at that hotel without having done their research and having had an idea that there was a game going on. Can you imagine trying to go for an early evening nap at 6 o'clock just before you go out for dinner and then finding out that you've got 3,000 really loud ultras right outside your window?
You'd have thought there was a riot going on or something, wouldn't you? You'd have no idea, especially because the atmosphere was so loud. I think, you know, even by the standards of other quite major games I've been to, it was deafening at points. So I love the thought of someone coming in, not realizing where the hotel's located, thinking, God, I'm just gonna have a little rest. You know, I've come in quite late, lying down on the bed and just being woken up by the sound of angry ultras chanting.
It was quite an atmosphere. We'll come back and talk about the game itself in just a second. But before we do, let's talk about the fan zone, because this was all part of the pre-match experience at Slavia. They've set up a fan zone fairly recently, I think, to sort of bring more of a community feel to the club and to get more people in and around the stadium directly before kickoff, which therefore improves the atmosphere. But that fan zone outside the stadium was pretty amazing, wasn't it? They had everything from branded Slavia Prague donuts to local beer to the Fat Fuck Smash Burgers, which brought a smile to both of our faces. I was a bit disappointed we didn't have one of those.
We didn't manage to get one of those. And I do think they've got a good future in England if they want to bring that franchise over. The Fat Fuck Smash Burger would be very popular. What was great about the beer as well was wasn't it brewed by the ultras, effectively? It was brewed by a group linked to the ultras. So everything felt very like linked to the club and its identity. Even the glasses you drink your beer from are like pictures of players on there, and you can donate your glass at the end to raise money for the ultra groups, I think, wasn't it? So everything was very, very nice kind of community feel to it. And I think we were saying it would be really interesting to see how this played out, because obviously you have one of the bitterest derbies that there is in Czechia. And we were wondering, you know, how is this going to hold up with having this quite nice sort of community feel, and it did work. But I think they have to be very careful with how the away fans arrive. We saw that, didn't we? The arrival of the away fans was quite a moment.
Yeah, I think obviously, especially because it was the derby, and we know that there is such a bitter rivalry there. But I think from the information we gathered, I think there is a section for the away fans as well, just segregated and probably not as cool as the home away sector that we saw. I really liked what you mentioned just a second ago about them raising money for the ultras, for the choreos, which we'll talk about in just a sec. But what they had is they had this system where 5 Czech crowns from every beer goes to the ultras. And as you say, if you choose not to get your deposit back and just donate your cup, that was 50 Czech crowns to the ultras. And I couldn't help thinking, in a country that has the largest beer consumption per capita in the world, they must raise quite a lot of money for that. Because there's actually on Wikipedia, there's a list of countries by beer consumption per capita table. And in second place is Austria, where I live. So 107.8 litres of beer consumed per year per person. But right out in front of Austria is the Czech Republic. The national average is 140 litres of beer per person per year. And that is just mental.
Wow. That is quite phenomenal, isn't it? I mean, we saw an awful lot of beer being consumed, and I'm sure, you know, there were probably some slightly unsavory aspects. We didn't see them ourselves, but I've got to say, people seem to be able to handle their beer. It didn't seem like there were people going around causing trouble or getting particularly leery on the beer. It was just people drinking really nice beer, which was very cheap. And I wonder if perhaps that is another aspect, that people in Czechia drink a lot of beer. They know how to handle it a little better than in the UK, because I do think we kept saying, I'm sure if this was in England by now there would be trouble. Mm. and there wasn't. People seem to manage to keep their emotions to the pyros and the tifo and the chanting in the stadium. It didn't spill over in any way.
Let's talk a little bit about the pyros and the tifos then, because we went into the stadium probably about half an hour before kickoff. We had one pitch side pass, so at the very start of the game I was down behind the goal with the aim of filming the pre-match choreo. And it was really amazing. This is the first time I've ever seen a choreo in a stadium that extends around half of the stadium. So it started at the ultras end behind the goal and then also covered one of the main stands. A big banner in Czech, which had a picture of the devil on one side, and it just said, "Welcome to Hell," which for me, reflecting back on the early Champions League days, was very Galatasaray vibes. I was on the pitch, but you were under the choreo, weren't you? So what was that like?
Well, it was quite a funny experience because we were seeing the one go up. So the first one went up with the main body of the ultras. So they're in the stand, which was just under my hotel room. And so we were looking across to that, me, myself and Joe, and we saw that one go up. And it's like, wow, we could admire this. And then we became aware of the fact one was coming up our side. And the funny thing is, you see it arrive, obviously, but you can't read it. It's just a sheet coming up over you. And so we spent quite a while just underneath it, trying to peek over the top. But it was an amazing experience being part of that. But somewhat, yeah, the irony is, when you are in the crowd, you can't actually see the product. So it's a funny experience. It's only when you came up and could show us the photo you'd taken of the two that we could understand vaguely what had been created.
Yeah, there were a couple more sort of displays, weren't there, throughout the game, which you then were able to see because they didn't cover our stand. We had, just before half time, we had a load of flares in the ultra section, which produced such a cloud of smoke that I think it's very fortunate that the halftime whistle was on the horizon, because you really couldn't see anything. And then in the second half, there was another choreo. I'm not sure, was it an eagle? Do you think that bird was an eagle?
I felt like it looked like an owl, but yeah. I may be not welcome with the ultras anymore if they've spent all week creating an eagle and now I've said it's an owl. But it looked like that. And then the eyes were the burning of the pyro through the eyes, which was very cool and probably pretty hard to orchestrate.
We were told during our trip by Jakub Splavets, Slavia Prague's director of strategic communications and an absolutely great host for us, that Slavia Prague have one of the top 6 ultra camps in the world, according to the Ultras World 2023 ranking. So the only clubs apparently in the world with better ultras are Raja Casablanca, Rapid Vienna, who I also saw a couple of days beforehand and are very good, Olympique Marseille, Legia Warsaw, And apparently the best ultras in the world are Wydad Casablanca in Morocco. So they're in some pretty good company there, I think. And I have to say, I was very, very impressed by what we saw. I couldn't help wondering if it was extra special just because it was a derby, or if that's the kind of vibe that you often get in that stadium.
I imagine it is extra special for the derby. I think Jakub said to us something like, the number of things they do is more for a derby. It's not that they don't do it for all the other games. It's just they go a bit more to town on the derby. And certainly it felt charged. It felt like this had been built up to for a long time. Even down to the fact that we were actually quite near the Sparta fans in the away end. There are only 1,000 of them. But in a stadium of 20,000, that's just, you know, a reasonable portion of the stadium. But they themselves deserve a lot of credit for the atmosphere they created. They sang every single minute, more or less. And there was obviously a leader, a sort of capo with a megaphone, and they bounced up and down. Even at 2-0 down, well, you know, they were bouncing up and down all game long and creating a noise that was much more than you'd anticipate. So I did feel like the atmosphere, they drew each other on. You know, it was like they were making so much noise, and so therefore the home fans would spark back up. But it felt very much like this was a special event to me. It didn't feel like just a regular game.
You mentioned there that Sparta were 2-0 down at one point. Perhaps we'll talk about the match itself now and run through the action, because I think Sparta probably made the marginally better start. And yet it was Slavia who took a 2-0 lead. They were 2-0 up by the 47th minute. The first goal I thought was quite nice, the way that Mojmor Shitil or Slavia beat a Sparta defender to the ball, touched it past him, laid it off to Ivan Schrantz, 1-0. And then there was a goal 2 minutes after the break by a player called El Hadji Malik Diouf, who is no family relation and has no connection to the El Hadji Diouf. But that put Slavia 2-0 to the good. And I think at that point, we thought that it was more or less sewn up, didn't we?
And it really could have been, I think. It was down to just a slight moment of a lapse of concentration that can happen at any point, and that let Sparta back in at 2-1. And suddenly these doubts started to surface again with Slavia that we'd seen in the early stages, where perhaps that link between the back line and the goalkeeper looked just a little fragile. There were just moments where the pace of the Sparta front line slightly unhinged them. And it was like we saw a repeat of the start of the game then, that suddenly Sparta looked really dangerous. The home fans got a little bit quieter, a little bit more edgy. The away fans amped up. And it really felt then like the game had turned on its head from 2-0 to 2-1. Was just a massive shift in the way the whole game felt. And there was still enough time left that it was clear that the game had a lot more life to it still to give.
I think the protagonists in that goal for 2-1 were probably sort of two of the key figures in the game, really. There was a key battle between the two Nigerians. So Ogbu of Slavia in defence and Olatunji of Sparta in attack. And they were in so many foot races with each other. And I think that I always felt that Olatunji was the slightly stronger player in that battle. He scored equalised for 2-2 in the 70th minute. And then it went to extra time. And then we have the most controversial incident of the game. In the 109th minute, Adam Karabets runs into the box on the left, hammers in a cross, and it's blocked. And the game continues. And then suddenly we see the referee running the full length of the pitch, initially thinking that he was going to deal with something happening in the crowd. But the VAR monitor was behind the far goal, and he was actually checking for a decision for a penalty, a potential handball from that cross, which had happened what seemed like minutes earlier.
It was bizarre, wasn't it? Because VAR had not been used at any other point in the game to that stage. As you say, the referee came darting over, and we had presumed something had happened, a disturbance either, maybe not in the crowd, but maybe one of the subs had got in an altercation or something, because he came across. And it was only when he then ran to give the penalty that we realised it was a VAR check. There was no announcement about this. It just, that's how it had gone. But we still weren't really totally sure what that was given for until we actually managed to speak to Jakub from Slavia the day after the game and say, you know, what actually was the penalty? And it was sort of what we suspected. It was given for a handball. Slavia, though, were adamant this wasn't a handball because the ball had come off a player's thigh and onto his arm, which would not be a handball, I believe, according to the letter of the law. And they insisted that the referee's view from the VAR check would not have indicated that. So that seemed to be, I mean, what a decision to give in front of this hostile home fans, knowing that this penalty will probably decide the game. If I'm honest, I think it was a bit of a disappointment that the game would be decided that way. Not least because we were slightly gearing up for penalties at that point, and we felt like that'd be quite a fun way to end the day for a neutral. But it did just feel a slightly damp squib for that to be the thing that decided a game that was so incredibly tight and so incredibly well fought, to be decided on something that I think is a harsh decision, if not a wrong decision.
I think we'll have a lot of match-going fans amongst our listeners as well. And I think there's probably a feeling that we came away from the stadium thinking that there's such a difference between your experience of VAR as a match-going fan and watching on TV. Because I feel like on TV, you're kept in the loop with exactly what's happening. And quite often when I'm in a stadium and a VAR decision is being made, you literally have no idea what's going on. And I really felt that for this last goal. I was just totally confused by that whole penalty decision.
Yeah, and that really does do damage to the live viewer experience, doesn't it? Because there's something really unsatisfying about a penalty being given after the event. You're not totally sure what it's been given for. That pause where you lose the exhilaration of the moment. So if a penalty is given instantly, you get that exhilaration because, you know, the action has followed on. That's the next bit of the action. But something for you just sitting there and just having those moments to sort of scratch your head and think, okay, it feels like something is really lost through VAR. And if VAR was brought in to remove controversy, then it certainly hasn't worked, because all that decision left there was Slavia actually filing a complaint, which they believe will be upheld. Not that will change the result or anything, but, you know, just to make their feelings clear. And the fans from Slavia feeling very hard done by. Obviously, the Sparta fans weren't complaining, but it does just feel like we lose something. If they'd just played on, nobody was arguing. Nobody was demanding this decision be changed. There weren't even Sparta players demanding it. So it felt very cold way to finish what had been an incredibly exciting spectacle.
I think that view was shared by Joe McTaggart, our Patreon competition winner, who was with us as well. We got a voice note from him with his take on the trip to Prague as a whole and the Prague Derby. So here's Joe from Edinburgh.
Hi guys, Joe McTaggart here, who's just back from Prague, having won the sweeper competition after being a patron. Very, very grateful for the opportunity presented to me from Lee and Paul. It's a couple of days that I'll never forget, as well as the lack of sleep I got. It was really, really amazing. What stood out to me, as well as Prague being a beautiful city, we got to see a wee glimpse of it due to the short amount of time that we had there. But the people were so, so friendly. Maybe because that we're being taken around by Slavia representatives, but they couldn't have been more welcoming and just so nice to us, and really interested into our backgrounds as well, especially myself being from Scotland. So it was really nice to meet different people. The quality on the pitch going forward from both teams was very impressive. I thought Slavia's backline was lacking something, and you could see that, especially the goalkeeper and the two centre halves were going to have a lot of issues. But when Slavia went two up, I really couldn't see them throwing it away. But that was exactly what happened. Olatunji up front for Sparta, as much as he annoyed me with his play act and his shooting was second to none, and he brought Sparta back into the game. I thought VAR was shambolic, as we've all seen, be that in Scotland or England or in Europe, but it was no different in Czechia. We had no idea that there was even an incident. We didn't even know there was VAR. Next thing we knew, there was a penalty with 10 minutes to go in extra time. Sparta ended up winning it, and I have to say, it was a very impressive away crowd from Sparta. The red wall behind the other goal was very impressive too, and on the whole, it was an incredible experience. That atmosphere was right up there with the other games that I've been to around the world, most importantly the Glasgow Derbies and Scotland-England games as well. Been really, really lucky to be to so many big games, and the Prague Derby was certainly up there.
Shambolic was the word that Joe used to describe the VAR. Do you have any final thoughts on the Prague Derby after hearing what Joe had to say?
Yeah, what I would say is, so as a tourist, as a complete neutral, which we were, we obviously ended up sort of wanting Slavia to win just simply because of the warmth of our hosts, but we were neutrals and we were in a country I don't know, first time there. I've got to say it was an excellent place to go for a football weekend, because while, you know, we come home and we've still got the memories of the pyro, the charged atmosphere, the ultras, it felt also incredibly safe as a neutral to visit. I didn't feel under any threat. It didn't feel a nasty derby. That's not to say that there might not be incidents where that does happen, or, you know, I can't speak for the general trend of Czech football over the years, but it felt like a really nice place to go. Beautiful city, really friendly, fantastic food, amazing beer, and just a very, very easy derby to have visited and had a great time. So yeah, I'd strongly recommend a trip. I'd also say the museum tour, which we were lucky enough to have from Jakub, who is actually, you know, fairly senior in the club. It was, I don't know if everyone would get that luxury if you don't sort of come through the media arm, but, you know, to be guided around this club and its history by someone who obviously really, really cares about it, it's amazing to have this insight into all that's happened in this club over the years. And I learned an awful lot, and I had a great time. I don't know what your feelings are, Lee, but I came away really buzzing from it.
I don't think I could sum it up better than that. I'd echo those sentiments. A big thanks to Slavia Prague for hosting us, and in particular to Jakub Splavec, who was a really great host. And I think, Paul, we picked the right Prague derby to go to, because the league game at the weekend ended 0-0. So I think we got it right.
Yeah, I did see that with a degree of pleasure, I've got to admit. I was also really intrigued, because obviously it's the reverse. So I was really intrigued to see how it would be for those Slavia fans, the thousand of them going to the Sparta arena. And yeah, 0-0, which actually does favour Sparta, who have a significant lead in the league, which probably is seen as a win for Sparta in a way, that 0-0 draw, even though they were on home territory.
You mentioned there that the day after the game, we went back for a tour of the ground, and Jakub has kindly given us two match-worn away Slavia jerseys to give away to our patrons. I think this is probably one of our coolest and most authentic giveaways to date. All you have to do for a chance to win one of them is to sign up to the Patreon at patreon.com/sweeperpod by Wednesday, the 13th of March. And just to specify on this giveaway, one shirt will go to an existing patron and one is guaranteed to go to a new sign up. So anyone who joins by that date will have a really good chance of winning a match worn Slavia Prague away shirt. We also have a scarf, don't we, in the home colours, which we're going to be giving away to a listener, patron or not, who leaves us a review out of 5 stars on Spotify by Wednesday, the 13th of March. Simply leave a review, screenshot it, and send us a picture by email to sweeperpod@gmail.com, and then we will pick a winner. That's it for part one, though. A big, big thanks to Slavia again, and we'll be back in just a second with 3 stories from 3 different continents in part 2. Welcome back to part 2 of this Sweeper podcast, which we're going to kick off with a story from either Croatia or Argentina or Mongolia. Paul, I'll let you decide this. Where do you want to kick off?
You know, I'm going to kick off in Argentina, even though I think we all know my heart's in Mongolia. I wanted to kick off with a story that came up. This was from Tears at La Bombonera. So that's at Bombonera Tears on Twitter. Very good source for Argentine football. And this was a story of a slightly unusual derby that played out between fans. So there was a series of games taking place, which they call La Fecha de Clásicos. So they have a week where there are a number of derbies. There were, I think, 7 of the Clásico derbies in Argentina taking place. And obviously, these are a big deal. These are like huge, passionately fraught derbies. Amongst them is Newell's Old Boys and Rosario Central. Like, this is a huge grudge match. That this is one of the biggest games there are for atmosphere. What I saw from this account, Tears at La Bombonera, was this amazing thing that had been set up by fans, that they'd played a fan game of Newell's versus Rosario Central. And it was just like a park, you know, with just normal people playing with the two teams' kits, I'm presuming fans of the teams. But what was abnormal was it was surrounded by a crowd that wouldn't be out of place in sort of, I don't know, League Two in this country or something. There were thousands of people watching, or at least it looked like there were thousands, at least hundreds. And there were pyro, there were people going crazy, there were fireworks. And it just looked like a really cool thing that had sort of reflected the exact passion that people have for these derbies.
Do we know how it finished up? The most important question of them all.
I know how the real game finished up. So in the game that they were doing this in anticipation of was Newell's hosting Rosario Central, and Rosario actually won 1-0 away, which is, you know, quite a dramatic outcome. I don't know what the result in the fan game was. Wouldn't it be quite amazing if it was exactly the same result?
The Fecha de Clásicos that you mentioned, this derby day that they've organised, I think sort of in a bid to create spectator appeal and get more interest from overseas, I think it's quite a good idea, to be honest, to have loads of derbies on one day. It makes it super exciting. I don't know if that then makes the rest of the calendar by default less exciting, but it's quite interesting that you have so many derbies in Argentina. And I was thinking, well, how is this possible? But if you look at the structure of the league, it's a 28-team league, which is absolute madness. And 15 of those clubs are based in Buenos Aires. So, of course, you're going to have loads of derbies.
So that would explain. I think we did speak about the size of this league before, didn't we? I think it was when there was a period where Boca Juniors were languishing, and they were in something really embarrassing, like 15th place. And we just realised how massive the league was at that point. But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of derbies. I think some are bigger than others. But, you know, we all think of River Plate versus Boca Juniors. That's obviously the one we all know about. Newell's and Rosario Central is probably quite well known. But there were a whole string of these derbies. I'm torn on whether doing them on a weekend is a good idea or not. I like it in theory, but as you say, does it in a weird way diminish each individual derby rather than having them on, you know, random weekends where suddenly you've got something to look forward to? I don't know.
On the topic of the 28-team league, is this the biggest top-flight league in the world? Surely it must be. I can't think of anything that would have more than 28 teams.
I certainly can't think of one that big. No, I would. If any of our listeners can think of a bigger league, please do let us know, because I cannot think of one for fairly good reason. I mean, it's absolutely unwieldy, isn't it, as a number?
Similarly, if you can think of what the smallest league in the world is, I know we've talked about the Scilly Isles before having this two-team division, but obviously it's not a FIFA country. If anyone can think of what the world's smallest league is in terms of clubs, please do send us an email to sweeperpod@gmail.com. We'd love to know that. I also just wanted to touch on a little bit of info I found out about Newell's Old Boys, because it's obviously not a Spanish language name. They are named after an Englishman called Isaac Newell, who was one of the pioneers of Argentine football. But I think even more interesting than the club name is their nickname, which is the Lepers, all because once in the 1920s, they played a charity match for a leprosy clinic, and they subsequently earned themselves the nickname the Lepers. Seems a bit harsh, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but isn't there a story that also goes that they played the game and were the Lepers, and that Rosario Central, the rivals, refused to play the game and were given their name the Scoundrels, Canallas?
Ah, okay.
I think that's it. So I think it was one of those ones where, again, both teams span it their own way.
interesting. I did not know that. I'm still hoping, and I will be to the end of my days, that there will one day be a friendly between Newell's Old Boys and Young Boys of Switzerland. But I think it's quite a long shot.
So there's two things I knew about Newell's Old Boys. One of them, of course, they have an incredibly famous former coach who the stadium is named after. I imagine you might know who that is, Lee. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Is that Bielsa?
It is indeed. It's the Estadio Marcelo Bielsa. The other one is that their shirts became quite popular as gag gifts, because if you've seen the Newell's Old Boys logo, it is a shield, half of it's red, half it's blue, with the letters for Newell's Old Boys, the acronym NOB. So it says knob on it. So for a little while, I think some slightly juvenile stag doos and such would buy that one, along with the Deportivo Wanker shirt, which was a staple, wasn't it? I can't even remember which country they were from, Deportivo Wanker, W-A-N-K-A. I think they're Peruvian, maybe. That shirt became quite popular as a gag gift too.
God, we're going to have to mark this episode full of expletives after the name of the burger place in part one, aren't we? Let's move on to Croatia now. We've got a bit of a controversial story. We talked about VAR controversy in Czechia in part one. Well, it has nothing on this story from Croatia. Have you heard about this? The leaked VAR audios in the Croatian top flight?
No, I have not heard about this.
Well, I'm going to take you on a white-knuckle ride of all the details. Hold on tight, and if you lose me at any point, do let me know. So this goes back to the seventh match day of the season back in September in a game between Dinamo and Osijek. And Osijek were winning 2-1, until the 87th minute when Dinamo scored two penalties in the 87th and the 99th minutes to win 3-2. And the first of those penalties, I felt, looking back at the action, was a little bit controversial because an Osijek player came charging out of the box with his arms in the air and did make contact with the ball, but it seemed to be either on the very edge of the area or just outside it. And the call was given that it was inside the box, so the penalty was awarded. But there was a lot of public indignation, and so as a result, the head of Croatian referees, Bruno Maric, organised a press conference the next day, and for the first time ever, he released the dialogue between referees. So you could hear exactly how they reached the decision, a bit like they do in the Premier League sometimes, and the audio was clear, calm, and professional. But last week, a series of audio recordings of conversations between referees over the whole season was leaked, and one of them was the recording from the Osijek Dinamo game, and it was chaotic, loud, and full of swearing. Basically, it wasn't the same recording.
Wow, that is a scandal. So they faked, or allegedly, they faked a new recording that they could make them sound very professional, when in fact it was sort of chaos.
Yeah, so according to Index HR, which we've used as a source for Croatian football before, that was when Ivan Perisic was earning €1 a week wages. The audio played at the press conference last September was fabricated, and the Croatian Football Association has since come out and said that the recording played at the press conference was made the day after the game in September and simulated the display of the work of the VAR room in order to show how the decision was reached. But that's not what was said at the press conference. So this has ultimately led to, along with another incident, which I'll explain briefly in a second, this has led to Bruno Maric, the head of Croatia's referees, being forced to resign. And the incident that sort of sparked this all was in another game between Varaždin and Hajduk, where a Hajduk split goal was ruled out for offside, but they couldn't accurately draw the lines of the defender's leg because it wasn't visible. So they used the closest defender and then overturned the original decision to disallow it. But that isn't following the VAR protocol, which would be to allow the original decision. So all of these things combined have led to a pretty big controversy in Croatia at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, how is this affecting Croatian football? Is this creating a bit of a shockwave in terms of, you know, I imagine there are a lot of aggrieved fans, clubs, a lot of trust has been lost here.
Well, I know there was that talk in the Premier League a while back of a game potentially being replayed. And even though they are in the title race, the Hajduk fans seemingly aren't really, pushing for any sort of replays or anything like that. That's what I've been told by Lovra Nikolac. He's the guy behind at Croatia Footy on Twitter, and it's been a great deal of help to me unpicking this story. But I think there is a lot of sort of outrage at the referees. People want to be told the truth and people want better refereeing standards. And this is all happening at a time when there is one of Croatia's more exciting title races, because the league has been won by Dinamo Zagreb every year since 2018. And at the moment, Hajduk are first and really in with a good chance of winning the title. So it seems to be overshadowing all of that, really.
What a crazy thing. And again, VAR creating this wave of chaos in its stead, which you just can't help but feel that the whole purpose of this being brought into the game was to remove pressures, to remove controversies, or at least relieve them. And you just can't help but think that we speak so much about it and it seems to be causing so much trouble in various ways that it's hard to see how we're better off with it in the game at all, to be honest.
I think so too. But we won't go too far into detail on VAR, because we have to, of course, go to Mongolia next before the episode is out. A happy place to end the podcast for you, Paul. Tell us a little bit about the resumption of the league season at the weekend and the Air Dome.
So yeah, the Mongolian Football League season has been changed over the last few years, and it's changed to create a really slightly bizarre mid-season gap. So they stopped playing back in November and then picked up the season now this last weekend. So it's a really long gap, and they are playing in the Air Dome, which is a relatively new structure that has allowed Mongolian football to take place in March when the temperatures would be, you know, somewhere between minus 10, minus 15 degrees. It's certainly unplayable outdoors. So this Air Dome is a slightly odd atmosphere because barely any fans can go to these games. It's a very small place. There's not really a provision for fans. It's a slightly odd, soulless atmosphere to it. But this is where they've restarted the season. And the game which caught my attention was the game between SP Falcons, Selenge Press Falcons, who are currently the runaway leaders in the league, which is a slight surprise, and a club that was formerly called Bayern Zug Sporting Ilch, who in mid-season have been taken over by Italian club Brera, who we've spoken about before, now own clubs in Mozambique, Macedonia, and now Mongolia, but don't actually have a club in Italy at the moment. This is part of a sort of multi-club ownership model that Brera FC is experimenting with. So what was quite unique in this game between the Falcons, who actually won 6-1, and the new club Brera Ilch, is that this was a mid-season takeover. The club had a new kit, they had a new badge, and were, to all intents and purposes, a new club, effectively starting their existence as a team that had 9 games on the board and 8 defeats. So they're sort of way at the bottom. And I don't think I've ever seen that before, a team change ownership, effectively change identity mid-season. I don't know, have you ever heard of that, Lee?
No, I don't think so. It's definitely a first, and that's what I said on the last pod, isn't it? Football always throws up these things that you've not seen before. I'm intrigued. What is Brera's policy here? Is it just to buy up clubs in countries that begin with M? Because that seems to be the only common denominator that I can discern so far.
Yeah, I did mention that when I spoke to the guys at Brera. It's a really cool model. If for people who don't know much about Brera, they call themselves the third Milan club, which I'm sure is maybe contested by some other clubs in the lower Italian system. But they have this history of effectively challenging and pushing at the limits of different aspects of football. So they are a club that like to take a different approach. So, for example, there was a spell where they had this policy. This was when they were in the Italian football system. They were at a relatively low level, I think 6th or 7th tier of the Italian system. They decided they would do away with training. All the other clubs in the league were training. Their whole motto was, we don't train. I think it was something like non un allenamento, solo talento. So it was like no training, just talent. And their whole thing was the team would not train. They would just turn up to games. And initially, their results didn't go brilliantly, I think, for the first season. They stuck with it. And then the second season, I believe they won the league. They were finishing above these teams that were training 2-3 times a week. And so they've got this history of being quite a subversive sort of challenger club. And I think this is a new part of that, is the idea is to get a series of clubs around the world and develop them in parallel with, I think they will eventually get another club into the Italian system, and have a sort of network of clubs to challenge this idea that multi-club ownership is always a kind of big, you know, slightly shady thing that, you know, is all about the multi-millions. I think the idea here is to do something that is more homegrown and, you know, helps these little outposts, you know, develop football. But at the same time, there is obviously a business imperative there. It's not a charity.
Having seen the air dome that they played this game in got me thinking about other indoor arenas, domes, stadiums. So the patrons have helped us out with some great suggestions. Sam says on Discord, Alta in the far north of Norway. So this is right up by Tromso way. They're in the third tier and they've got an indoor ground where they play their games at this time of year. We have the Arkoshallen in Luleå, which was where Malmö played that Swedish Cup tie just over a week ago. But interestingly, they're not all in the Nordic nations. The Sheriff Sports Complex in Transnistria. I don't know. You've been there, haven't you, actually?
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. So they've got this outdoor stadium, and then they've got an indoor dome, and then several training pitches as well. I mean, it's all comes across as a little bit obscene in a country where there's no money and a lot of teams are just playing on a field somewhere. But I did think of them. And then I also thought of El Logistico, the derby between the two Lithuanian logistics companies, which we'll be talking about a little bit on the Patreon pod. That was also played in an indoor hall in Kaunas. So there's quite a few of them, really, mostly in the summer leagues.
There are quite a few. And I was actually sent a reply to my tweet about the Mongolian game from at JLender on Twitter, saying I attended a game in Estonia around this time of year and it was played indoors. But interestingly, he said there was a rule change that every time the ball hit the ceiling, the opposite team were awarded a throw-in. And I'd sort of heard of that. You remember when you used to play indoor with those furry footballs? You used to play indoor hall football with those. Like, I think that was the rule there, but I'm pretty sure it was a free kick that the other team got if you booted the ball. But I tweeted back to say, exactly how high were these clearances going? And it turned out the roof was a lot lower, I think, than the dome we were looking at for Mongolia. But still, I was surprised to see the ball could be hoofed high enough to hit that roof. But it looked quite low, yeah, compared.
All right, well, I think that sort of brings the episode to an end today. But as I say, we do have the Patreon bonus segment, which you can listen to right now, coming up. We're going to be talking about some stories from the summer leagues. And what else are we going to be talking about, Paul?
We're going to be looking at clubs who are living up to their names or not living up to their names. So we're going to be going through some of the more interestingly named football clubs in the world and having a look at whether we think they justify those names.
Very nice. Well, I've got a little surprise for you at the end of that as well. So that is available to listen to now at patreon.com/sweeperpod. But otherwise, we will see you for another episode on Wednesday, the 13th of March.